Some people will travel to the ends of the earth just to see what nature can teach them up close. Noah Stricker's early interest in learning about birds has already flown him all over the world to study habitats from the Amazon and the Australian outback, all the way to the Arctic and the Antarctic. In 2011, Noah hiked the entire Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. And that's the year he also published Among Penguins, about his time with a research team in Antarctica. Today, Noah divides his time between seasonal ornithology fieldwork and writing as an associate editor at Birding Magazine. His latest book is an entertaining narrative about the surprising things different species of birds can reveal about being human. It's called The Thing with Feathers, and it includes chapters about dancing parrots, competitive hummingbirds, chickens, starlings, bowerbirds, owls, pigeons, and, of course, penguins. Noah, thanks for joining us today on Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, Rick. Nice to be here.
You observe that birds are highly intelligent, but their intelligence is different from human intelligence and therefore often misunderstood. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yes, we often refer to being bird-brained.
That's right.
And I think attitudes on that are changing. You know, just in the past couple of decades, scientists have been studying birds in a different way than they were before. So traditionally, we've been so focused on defining ourselves as humans and separating us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And now lately, it's switched, and we're more studying how we're similar to our feathered friends and other animals out there.
A lot of people call me bird-brained, and now I can say thank you.
Yeah, I would say that's a compliment.
Oh, right. So, but how is their intelligence different from human intelligence? How are they misunderstood?
Well, I think it's hard to know what it's like to be a bird, and we can only get at it from various angles of studying birds in labs and watching their behavior in the field. But I think that birds have the same basic needs that we do as people. They need food and water and shelter, and they want to raise a family, and they want to leave a legacy, and they want to live a good, prosperous life just like we do. And so in writing this book, I was surprised by many of the bird behaviors that we are studying in hardcore science now, how you can apply those back to us and even learn a few lessons about ourselves from the world of birds.
So what's an example?
Well, I got interested in self-image in birds. In other words, when a bird looks in a mirror, what does it see?
Because you wrote about how magpies are particularly distinct in this ability. They actually can recognize themselves in a mirror.
Exactly, and we tend to take that for granted as humans.
Because humans can do that, but that's unusual in the animal kingdom.
Uh-huh, and there's a test you can do called the mirror test, which is where you put a little speck of paint on an animal's forehead and put it in front of a mirror and then watch what happens. And if it looks at the mirror and it starts scratching its forehead, it means it recognizes its reflection and it realizes it had something weird on its face.
Oh.
But if it attacks its reflection or tries to mate with its reflection or walks around the backside of the mirror to look for this other animal, then that's a fail. And
so, now that's a dumb bird who sees himself in the mirror and tries to mate with it.
It happens.
It happens. You have an interesting job. All right, what about memory? I mean, you write about how nutcracking birds have memory that can rival or even surpass human memory.
Yeah, there's this bird called a Clark's nutcracker, which lives in the high mountain pine forests of western North America. They're related to crows and magpies, so they're in that family of birds called corvids, which is known to be pretty clever. Hmm. And they have one special claim to fame. Nutcrackers, every year in the late summer and fall, gather pine seeds and then cache them in the ground, burying them just like squirrels. And the thing is, one individual nutcracker might, in one season, bury tens of thousands of pine seeds and then be able to remember where every single one of them is, even months later, even sometimes after a couple feet of snow have fallen on the ground.
So they could play, like, you know, that card game Concentration?
They would kill us.
They'd be very good at concentration. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about nutcrackers and birds trying to mate with themselves in the mirror and all sorts of interesting things with Noah Stricker. And Noah's written a book called The Thing with Feathers, sharing what he has observed from studying birds for a long time. He's the associate editor of the American Birding Magazine. And Noah, you've done a lot of travels. As a well-traveled birder, what are some of the most wildly rewarding places you've ever gone that we might, as travelers, consider going and looking at birds?
Well, first of all, just being a birder One of the best things about it is that you get to travel so much, because the thing about birds is everywhere in the world you go, there will be birds there. Even if you go to the South Pole, birds have been recorded there. And so birding takes you to places that you would never go to otherwise. And I think that's really cool.
What's an example? Where have you gone because you were looking for birds and you realize, hey, birds are not, I'm glad I went here?
Well, other than the local landfill and sewage pond and airport runway, those are all good places to go bird watching. But it seems like birding is like this treasure hunt, and it gives you a map and a quest, and then it's up to you to go out and find the birds. So this year, I spent a couple months in the high Arctic up on Svalbard, which is an isolated island archipelago about 1,000 miles north of Norway. And that is a very cool place. In terms of bird diversity, it doesn't have a lot of species, because as you go toward the poles, there are fewer and fewer birds, but the ones that are found there are really cool.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Noah Stricker about birds. Allie emailed us from Spokane in Washington, and Allie writes, we loved seeing puffins on Haystack Rock at Cannon Beach in Oregon in the summertime. Do you have any recommendations for a good pair of binoculars that would help us see birds like this up close?
Okay, yeah, well, first of all, Haystack Rock is a great place, probably the best place in Oregon to see tufted puffins. And so if you're there between about April and August, you can go out to the beach and use any old pair of binoculars or even a camera to zoom in on any of the green areas around the rock, and you'll see tufted puffins sitting next to their nesting burrows, and they're a beautiful bird.
Mm. Now, what about binoculars? Birders must just, that's the most essential tool, I would think.
Yes. So my advice on buying any sort of optics, including binoculars, is always just suck it up and spend as much as you possibly can, because the highest end ones really are worth it. If you're going to be using your pair of binoculars in the field for, mm-hmm. you know, the rest of your life, potentially, mm-hmm. it's worth it to have a really good pair.
Now, how big of an issue is the size of it? Because as travelers, we like things that are portable. Do you compromise a lot to get something smaller?
I really like the pair of binoculars I use are Leicas, and they are a 8x32 pair. And they're fairly compact, so I can wear them around my neck mm-hmm. all day long, as I do sometimes, and even forget them on and take them to dinner.
These birders take their binoculars to dinner.
Happens once in a while.
All right. You know, in your book, you talk about all of these different aspects of bird intelligence, and you talk about fairy wrens that are actually charitable. They exhibit altruism. How can you observe a bird and figure out that they have a charitable heart?
What fairy wrens do is very interesting, because it's rare in the bird world. They are cooperative nesters. So they nest on riparian areas, which are along streams, and a dominant pair will set up a territory, just like other birds do, and keep all the other fairy wrens off it so that they can have access to all the food that's there and build a nest and raise their chicks. The thing that's different with fairy wrens is they will allow sub-adult younger birds to squat on their territory and not chase them away, as long as those younger birds essentially pay their rent by helping feed the chicks in the dominant pair's nest. So you end up getting sometimes 7 or 8 different fairy wrens all bringing food in and tending the same nest, which is quite unusual.
That just sounds amazing. And then the key is, as a birder, to realize, to be able to observe this and then actually to be able to try to draw conclusions from that they are being charitable.
Well, that's the question is, are these younger birds who are helping feed the nest, is this, you know, an example of altruism, or are they just coldly calculating their chances of inheriting this territory when the older birds die and then they can move in and eventually have chicks of their own? So it's, you can kind of see this either way, that either altruism exists in the universe and you can do something purely out of the goodness of your heart, and this applies to people too, or do all of our actions ultimately, are they all selfish?
Now, some of my favorite memories with birds are sitting on the deck of my cabin on a cruise ship and lobbing little chunks of cracker or bread up into the sky, and these seagulls will time it, and they'll swoop around and grab it like acrobats in midair. And it seems to me that the birds are playing, but somebody told me birds don't play. Everything for them is just trying to get enough food to survive. Are they actually playing? Do they enjoy this, or are they just thinking food?
Personally, I think that birds totally play. I've watched penguins slide down hills and then get to the bottom and walk back up to the top and do it again.
I love it.
Last year, there was a viral video going around of a crow that was using a little piece of plastic to sled down a rooftop, and then it would carry it back up to the top and do it again.
Nice. I've seen birds on statues in Siena line up and slide down the snout of a sculpted animal just to get to the end to drink out of the fountain that's spurting out of his mouth. And I just stared at it for the longest time, and it really seems to me that they are just having fun.
Yeah, there's no reason, evolutionarily speaking, that something like playing should be limited to us humans.
Noah Stricker is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He's the author of The Thing with Feathers, The Surprising Lives of Birds and What They Reveal About Being Human. Noah's website is noahstricker.com. That's spelled S-T-R-Y-C-K-E-R. Noah, when you think about the activities of these birds and trying to better understand it, I was just on YouTube looking at this thing called murmuration with starlings, like billions of starlings, flying in close formation and zigzagging all around the sky in unison, like as if they were following the baton of some cosmic conductor. When you sit down and look at a giant flock of starlings in tight formation, swerving left, swooping right, what do you think? How do you explain that?
Well, for anyone who hasn't heard of a starling murmuration, you should go to YouTube right now and type in the word murmuration and see what you get. Murmuration is just the collective noun for a flock of starlings. And they make these huge flocks in the winter, usually around dusk, just before they go to their roost for the evening. And sometimes they can contain more than a million individual birds in one flock. And so from a distance, when they're swirling around, forming these intricate patterns that look sort of like smoke, it's hard to stand there and not just look at them and wonder, how do they all manage not to bump into each other and fall out of the sky?
How do they?
Well, for many years, biologists have scratched their heads about how to study big flocks of birds like this. They act kind of like swarms of insects. They act kind of like big schools of fish, but they're different. And it's kind of like trying to study a tornado. Capturing that in the act and then somehow taking data off of it is very difficult. And it was only recently when a group of Italian physicists decided to look at starlings. These guys had virtually never looked at birds in their entire lives. They were mathematicians. And they approached it from a particle physics standpoint and tried to write equations that would describe starling flocks. And they came up with some interesting results where they were comparing starling flocks to things like avalanches breaking loose from mountains and pieces of iron becoming spontaneously magnetized. So maybe it's all just strictly mathematical. And as far as we can tell, these flocks of starlings and probably fish have no leaders. They're very organic, and they just behave almost according to certain rules and laws of the universe that govern these very intense patterns.
Fascinating. You know, albatrosses are famous for having both long lives and also mating for life. How is it that albatrosses have such a low divorce rate?
Yeah, we've studied albatross divorce rates. In other words, what percentage of pairs of albatrosses will split up before one of them dies? And in some cases, that can be as low as 0.1%, which is pretty crazy. And it kind of makes you wonder about the 0.1%.
Better than humans.
Yeah, human divorce rates are around 40 to 45% around the world. And that puts us on about the same romantic level as a seabird called the Nazca booby.
Spoken like a good birder, relating human divorce rates to the animal kingdom. And speaking of falling in love, the bowerbird is famous for creating his own little bachelor pad, right? Tell me about how that can be appealing and effective to get a mate.
Bowerbirds are interesting. They live in Australia and New Guinea. And the male bowerbird will build a structure in the forest that looks like a little hut, usually, that he will then decorate with various colorful objects that he finds around the forest, like brightly colored berries and leaves and wings torn off of colorful beetles, and make these elaborate arrangements that are strictly visual, that has no purpose at all other than to attract the attention of a passing female. And if she likes his display, she'll mate with him and then go off and build her own nest by herself and raise the chicks. And he will continue living in his bachelor pad, hoping to attract another female.
So bachelors can learn from the bower bird to decorate their place a little bit, and they may get a little better bitter luck.
The prettier it is, the more females it attracts.
Now, you wrote a book about penguins a few years ago called Among Penguins. Tell me about studying penguins and how are they unique? I know that people are just wild about penguins, especially when they've seen them on one of these trips down to Antarctica. And I understand penguins only live in Antarctica, right?
Well, there are 18 kinds of penguins in the world, more or less, depending on how you define a species. And only two of them are totally restricted to Antarctica. So the other 16, you can find on the southern parts of South America and South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and a bunch of sub-Antarctic islands.
Okay. What's your favorite thing about penguins?
Penguins just have this incredible charisma and energy and personality and curiosity about them. If you ever get the chance to walk around a colony of Adelie penguins in Antarctica, it is an extraordinary experience because these birds have grown up without any fear of predators on land. And so they have no fear of us. They'll walk right up to you, untie your shoelaces, run circles around your feet. They'll come up and preen the side of your pants like you're some gorgeous mate they want to be with for the rest of their life. They'll follow you around just waiting for you to entertain them like you're some gigantic space alien that just dropped in.
So that's because they have no predators?
Right. So all the other continents have land predators on them. And,
sure.
And for something like a penguin, that might mean that they would get eaten.
So what a beautiful thing. If you can put up with the cold of Antarctica, you don't have any predators, and then you don't need to be afraid of strange men.
Sounds like an ideal life, doesn't it? It just gets down to about 80 below in the winter.
If you can handle the cold. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking birds with Noah Stricker, and Noah's new book is called The Thing with Feathers. Noah, how on earth did you get so enamored with birding? How'd you get started in this?
I had a teacher in the fifth grade who put a bird feeder on our classroom window that suction cupped right up to the glass. And she'd stop class every time a new bird showed up and make us identify it. And the other six kids in my class thought this was the dumbest thing ever. And for me, for some reason, something sparked and I got interested in identifying birds, and I went home and started trying to figure out what was in my backyard. My mom and dad have about 20 acres of forest outside of town, so our yard is very birdy. And from there, it was just an addiction that has never, ever stopped.
And what are some of the places you've traveled with your curiosity about birds?
So far, my interest in birds has taken me to six continents. Africa will be my last. The coolest places I have lived have been in the Amazon, in Costa Rica and Panama, in the Australian outback, and in Antarctica. And the best place is always the next one.
Noah Stricker, thanks so much for joining us, and best wishes with your birding, and thanks for inspiring all of us to be a little more attentive to these surprisingly intelligent creatures that are flying all around us all over this planet.
My pleasure.
You can add your comments to what you hear each week on Travel with Rick Steves and find web links to our guests in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Next, we'll examine how Japanese society is reacting to its prolonged economic slowdown as we check in with a Canadian business journalist in Tokyo. It's Travel with Rick Steves.